Welcome to Season 3 of Bridge the Gap, a podcast dedicated to inform, educate, and influence the future of housing and services for seniors. Powered by our supporting partners, TIS Insurance, Morrison Living, NRC Health, One Day, Argentum, The Bridge Group Construction, and Salinity. Find out more about this podcast at btgvoice.com.
Welcome to Bridge the Gap podcast with Josh and Lucas. We're at the NIC conference where the energy is continuing to rise here, and we are bringing on thought leaders left and right. And this has been, candidly, a bucket list item for me. Well, I would like to welcome Rick Matros, the CEO of Sabra, to the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. Thanks for taking time. So there's a lot to talk about. And the Sabra has been in the news for senior living. There's a lot of different things, but we want to take it a little bit of a different direction because you're a polarizing leader figure. And we'd like to understand more about your background of what has led you to this point and how you've been able to develop a culture in a major league realm of processes and procedures, and just kind of your idea of how you've done that.
Sure. So went to grad school in gerontology and took my first job as an activity director in a nursing home. Actually, we were double hatters back then. I was activities and social services. You don't do that anymore, but back then. And got my administrator's license. And the first job I had, the company went bankrupt in my third week. But not like a bankruptcy today where you have debtor in possession financing and all this. We had no payroll. And I was 23 and like, what the hell, right? But I really liked it, actually. And my whole background had been psychosocial. And I still, to this day, never had a business course. So I just had this acclimation for it that I didn't know that I had. And so then after that, I just pursued, kind of turnaround opportunities and things like that. And wound up with a company that was pretty entrepreneurial. So culturally, it was a good fit for me. The guy who was running it sort of took me under his wing. Then we got acquired by a really large company, and that was sort of very traditional, top-down, buttoned-up corporate culture. And I didn't wear Brooks Brothers. I liked European, and had earrings, and my hair was long, and it was tough. And I did pretty well there, but I just couldn't breathe. And I kind of made a promise to myself that if I was ever sort of in the position to have some level of leadership, that everything would always be about the culture. And that, our business is a mission-driven business. And if you don't have a culture where everybody that comes to work every day, it doesn't matter what their position is, they have to believe they bring value to the business. And they have to believe that you don't think you're any better than they are, because you're not. You may have this position and make more money or whatever, so that may give you some different opportunities in life, but it doesn't make you a better human being. And so so I just sort of looked for those opportunities, and those opportunities usually wound up in the realms of bankrupt companies and things like that. So that's really what I did. And that was so it was always culture, and that was always the centerpiece of everything that I try to do, because that's really the only thing that can differentiate you from the guy down the street that you're competing with, is your culture. And so so did a couple of bankruptcies and grew those companies. And I actually left the industry about 20 years ago after I sold the last one that we had turned around with the team. And I got into the dental business and the traumatic brain injury business and started two other companies. And then remember about PPS, there were a lot of bankruptcies, and so I started getting contacted. Then I wound up going to Sun Healthcare, and we got them out of bankruptcy, rebuilt them. And then about 9 years ago, we created Sabra, the REIT. We spun it out of Sun. We took all the real estate and separated the two companies. And then I decided to jump over to the REIT, primarily because, I'd given my life to operations, but operations, as you guys know, it's 24/7. And by then, I'd been getting involved in a lot of other just causes and organizations that are important to myself and to my wife, and we knew we'd have sort of grandkids coming and all this, and I wanted to have more time. And so at a REIT, you're really kind of a deal shop, and I went from 30,000 employees to 7 in one day, going from Sun to the REIT, which for most people is enough reason to make the change, you know. But and we've gone in 9 years, we've gone from $700 million in assets to $7 billion, and we've gone from 7 employees to 32. That's it. And so we. So one of the joys, and this sort of goes to the whole culture thing, one of the joys of being at Sabra is, you know, when you've got tens of thousands of employees, no matter how hard you try, it's hard to have that culture consistent throughout. You've got a lot of local, you know, local leadership, and everybody's got their own styles, and it's a constant challenge. And but at Sabra, we pretty much have almost everybody in one place, and it's not that many. And the way we structured it was we outsource, I didn't want any traditional corporate functions. We outsource legal, HR, IT, payroll. We don't do anything. So the only people that work at Sabra are the ones that are just focused on that mission. You know, investment specialists, asset managers, finance accounting, that kind of stuff. And so I've been able to do everything that I always wanted to do for my employees. You know, everybody gets equity in the company. No one's on the clock. Two-thirds of our workforce is millennial. And so that kind of culture kind of suits that group. And we've had the same senior and middle management team since day one. No one's left the company. And so it's been two-thirds of the workforce is female. And it's just been, it's great. And we do things, you know, in December, I take all the employees to Cabo for a couple of days just to have fun and thank them for the year. There's no education, there's no agenda. All my employees get invited to every one of our quarterly board dinners. So, you know, there's no difference in benefits for anybody. It's all, everything's kind of the same. So, you know, it's really been fun.
So you just gave us a lot of history and a lot of success stories that I know there's a lot of details behind. I appreciate the details you gave us on like what culture kind of looks like right now.
Yeah.
One thing, we've got a broad growing group of listeners that are leaders at a variety of different capacities and levels. Can you think of just from a pattern standpoint of all these different success stories that you had in a lot of different types of businesses and even different areas within our industry that you've been successful? What are some guiding principles that have been consistent that you've kind of deployed that you could kind of boilerplate for that, maybe that young leader that's saying, hey, from the experience, these are some principles that no matter what you're doing, these work to building great teams?
Sure. So one, I think, is you can't be afraid to fail. You learn more from failure anyway, but you just can't be afraid. And it doesn't mean that you take thoughtless risks. You can take thoughtful risk. And what's really the downside? If it's thoughtful risk, it's not going to destroy the business or anything. But it's important, if you really want to have that mindset, you've got to be in a culture, in a company that actually supports that mindset. But that's... to me really critical, is because that's what builds people's confidence over a period of time, is, man, I messed up, but I'm going to learn from it and be better for it. You know, and that part's really cool. The other is just really staying humble. And you see people that become successful and, you know, they just think they're the smartest person in the room and all that sort of stuff. And for me, I always I look for people that are smarter than me all the time to have my team and have completely different skill sets and all that kind of stuff. And I think you can't, if you're successful at all, I mean, everybody that's got any level of success, no matter what they're in, whether it's sports or academics or whatever, you've got a healthy ego, but that doesn't mean you can't be humble. And I think that humbleness is important. And when you lose that, I think that's when you lose sight of what makes things work. And when you're in our business, if you're not humble in our business,
right?
I mean, stuff happens all the time and you're responsible for people's lives. So, but I think that, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have any level of success, you have to be self-aware enough to make sure that you don't let that stuff, you know, kind of get to your head.
Yeah.
So those are just some guiding principles.
That's great. And so you mentioned you have, I think you said you had a healthy number of the younger workforce, millennials. Yeah. And what are some things that you're doing to attract that kind of group? Because obviously we need a lot of those folks. We had a student from Cornell on previously, and he gave us a great perspective from a millennial's perspective, which is great. We need to be hearing about that. But as a experienced leader, what are some of the things things that you're doing to attract them, because they seem like they want a little bit different culture to work in?
So one, I think it's somewhat easy for me because my wife says I'm a mental millennial,
okay,
which I think is a shot, but you know, I think it's a compliment. She thinks she's, you know, giving me a shot, but you know, but I think a couple of things when we bring them in and we talk about the job and all that kind of stuff. And I try to meet everybody before, you know, they get their offers and all that kind of stuff. We talk about having an environment that is collaborative, where we really trust them. You know, they're not on the clock, that we want them to be able to have balance in their lives, which is really a really big issue for them. And so, you know, there are cycles where, you know, in any business, it's 24/7, but then it's not. And if you want to take a couple of days off and go hang with whatever or go do something, we don't care. You know, we don't care. And I think having a culture where they know that they can make some of those decisions as long as they get the job done, you know, I think it really helps. And I think the fact that organizational structures are there to keep some semblance of order, but that doesn't mean you have to go up and down to get things done. So that sort of cross-communication, just go and talk to whoever you want, whenever you want in the company. It's the same thing with having employ all of our team at the board dinners. I'm not going to be paranoid about my board members talking to whoever they want to talk to in the company. They can talk to whoever they want in the company, you know. And I think most people that have been around for a long time aren't used to that. My board members weren't. they weren't, like, used to that, you know. But for, you know, younger individuals, for, you know, people in their 20s and early 30s, to have, you know, that kind of exposure and trust. So I think that's really what it is. It's a whole exposure and trust thing. You know, I'll sit around and talk to them about whatever. You know, it doesn't even have to be about the business. Sometimes they're just going through some crap and they just want to talk about it. And, you know, sometimes it's easier to talk to someone that's older that isn't your parent, right? And so we have a small enough group, I think, that why not do all that stuff?
You read about leaders struggling with actually, you know, you take on the problems of your team a lot of times, and you almost have to be a psychologist, and you have that background in training.
Yeah.
It seems like that those have really been interwoven to create a successful team.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think I was a psych major in college and kind of psych and gerontology in graduate school, and I think that has really helped me a lot. And, you know, it's helped me to just trust my instincts. You know, you can look at deals and you can look at things and you've got all these numbers, but at the end of the day, you've got to just feel like it's right.
Sure.
You know, and it's the same thing when, like when I interview people that come onto the team, I don't want to have a conversation with them about their abilities because they've already interviewed with two other people, so I know they're technically competent. I just want to have a conversation so I can get some sense, just from a chemistry perspective, if I think they can fit in the culture. There are some people that flourish in environments that are more prescriptive, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's what you best function, you're just not going to make it with us. You know, so that's where I think it's helped me with a lot of that stuff.
So peel back the layers a little bit. You know, it's fascinating to me. You've got so many irons in the fire, so many success stories, leading a huge organization with a lot of deals and making a lot of things happen. How do you stay fresh? How do you stay hip? How do you stay cutting edge? And how do you keep these fresh thoughts?
I think a couple of things. I practice yoga every day.
Okay.
I never miss a day, whether I'm on the road or not. And that actually helps a lot. And I don't just love tattoos. I've been getting tattooed for 30 years, but I'm involved with a project called Healing Inc., where we bring really well-known tattoo artists from the States to Israel every year, and they tattoo survivors of terror attacks and IDF vets that have physical wounds and PTSD. The same group was just in Virginia in December. It was a one-year anniversary of the massacre there. We had tattooers at the Pulse Disco in Orlando where the shootings were. So it's a way for people to reclaim their bodies and heal in a way they didn't think they could. And so there's a point to all this.
No, I love the story.
And so being involved, so I've gotten really involved Like, I know a lot of tattooers, and we're really good friends and all that kind of stuff, which is the opposite. I just came from the Citibank conference, and I was at the Wells conference last year. Talk about groups that I interact with that couldn't be, like, more different, right?
But that helps keep you fresh.
It does help keep me fresh. And we were in Israel with the group in November, and we're sort of in the van, and one of the tattooers, his name is Southpaw, is playing these songs, and they're like, "What is that?" I'm like, "Oh, that's from DaBaby's new album." They're like, "What?" Like, everybody there is like in their 20s and 30s, right? Like, "Yeah, that's DaBaby's new album." Like, oh shit,
you're in the know.
Well, but I make recommendations to my kids all the time, so I buy new music every week, and that really helps.
It's, yeah,
you know, because excuse me, I never really understood how people hit a certain point and they don't listen to anything after that.
Right, right.
You know? You even see that with younger generations.
Right. If,
you know, anything before, you know, 1995, right? I don't know anything about it. And I love music, so every week I look at everything new that's coming out and I pick stuff and...
You taste, you're curious.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I love that. Well, and it's refreshing to see. I'm just sitting here and I'm looking at these tattoos and I'm thinking, I bet every single one of these has some kind of meaning,
yeah,
or there's something, some significance in a story you're able to tell through that. And sounds like the, I would call it a ministry, what you're doing in Israel with that mission of ink, as you referred to it. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah,
I love
you should
that.
Check it out. It's healinginc.org. It's really, you'll see really cool stuff in the story. You'll see videos. You guys will cry. Hmm. You guys will just cry.
I'm definitely going to check that out. We'll have to talk offline. My dad is about over there about 6 months out of the year, so I have a great appreciation.
Oh, yeah?
For Israel, and I've spent a little time over there myself, so that's fascinating. I'll definitely have to connect with you on that.
Yeah, I get there a lot. I work with a lot of different groups there, so
that's awesome.
So, do you have a favorite tattoo or one that's really kind of? Kind of like, it's hard to say, like, you can't pick your favorite child. Like.
Yeah, it's usually my most recent, but this one is actually one of my favorites. It's the sacrificing. You got Abraham, Isaac, the lamb, mm-hmm. the angel.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot going on.
There's
in this
a full
space.
Story there, yeah.
Yeah, and this was done by Wasim Razouk, who's got a tattoo shop in the Old City in Jerusalem. It's the oldest tattoo business in the world. Excuse me, his family started it in the year 1300 in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been passed down from generation to generation, so over 700 years.
Wow, that's
like
so
unbelievable.
Cool.
It's incredible.
It's unbelievable, yeah. So I've got, I think I have like five from him, so plus he's just an awesome dude, so he's a Christian Arab living in the Old City.
Yeah. So talk about real quick, I know we don't have much time left, but we talked with a couple of different REITs, and it seems like REITs are the traditional REIT model. They're having to get a little bit creative with the changing of times. Are there things where you have some initiatives or some things that you're trying to do in partnership with operators to try to work with the changing culture and environment of care?
Yeah, so I think, a couple of things. One, we're a little bit different than our peers in that I've spent my whole life as an operator. My CFO's from the operating side. My whole asset management team are operators. And that's not typical of a REIT. You know, most REIT asset managers are super smart, sort of MBA.
Yeah, financial market guys.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we speak the same language, and we understand the ups and downs. And so I think there's just from, going back to cultural, from a cultural perspective. And when I was on the operating side, I had leases with every REIT. So I kind of knew who I liked, who I didn't like, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And so there's that part of it that it's easier for us, I think, to get involved in doing some different things with them. But then outside of that, we're the first REIT, we're in the behavioral space, and we're in the addiction space. The addiction space is a brand new space, really. It's very young. And we just formed our first two relationships on the addiction side. And fortunately, our country, too many years too late, policy is changing, and there's a level of awareness that mental health issues are real. And the addiction issues are diseases, and so that's those are spaces that are relatively new to us, and as I said, no one else is really in them, and it's a little bit hard to grow in them because there aren't that many tried and true operators, so it's going to take a while. I think it'll be incremental, and in the addiction space, there's a lot going on with trying different models. You know, everybody hears about 12-step. there's also a really high recidivism rate. So is that program as effective? And I mean, you guys are in the business. Mm-hmm. How many times do you think you can put a cookie cutter program together and that's going to be good for everybody?
Right.
So, you know, we're trying to align with operators that are taking sort of a different look at things and having things like we would do in our facilities, whether they're skilled or senior housing, where you're going to tailor things specific to the needs of an individual.
Yeah.
So we're really excited about being in those two spaces and, you know, hopefully be a good capital partner that will result in some good for folks.
Well, you sparked a thought because I've often thought on the addiction space. I think most often, at least me, when I think of the addiction and those type of care communities or facilities, I think of younger people. But you know, with psychotropic drugs and seniors, I personally witness a lot of addicted senior adults to medications. It seems like do you think there's ever a spot or a growing sector within the addiction that we'll see that specialized towards senior adult addiction?
Yeah, I think at some point, and you are seeing that in the behavioral space where you've got the complete age range
right.
that get treated. And so I do think you'll see that. I think it's a ways off, but look, the opioid addiction brought a whole different level of awareness, and the only problem I have with the whole thing, and this is sort of this will be my political statement, it's because it hit middle class white America.
Sure.
You know, no one cared about the crack epidemic, mm-hmm. right? Because it was inner city.
Right.
And it was imported.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So, so that's why. I mean, I'm glad it's all happening now, but it's just, that kind of stuff's always interesting to me. It's like, okay, soccer moms have opioid addictions. We better put a lot of money into it.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of truth to that statement. There really is.
Yeah. But it's needed.
Yeah.
It's just I wish we'd get to a point where everybody's treated with the same level of importance in terms of services.
Absolutely.
You know?
Truly.
It's a really great point. It is. So fascinating. It's fascinating to see how our industry's changing, the challenges that are creating. What we like to say with every challenge, there's a great opportunity ahead.
Absolutely.
And so we're excited about that. It's fun to see the culture you've created at multiple levels and just the whole vibe that surrounds you. That's really cool.
I appreciate it. It's fun. You have to have fun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, one of the fun things that Nick is involved with that I have the honor of being some influence in with the Future Leaders Council here is university outreach. And we know that that's actually a big part of what you're doing at your alma mater. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so it's really, I think, only been in more recent years that our industry's really been viewed as a valid career path for well-educated people. So I think it's incumbent upon those of us that have experience or been around, whether it's to our alma maters or if they don't have any programs like that, to other schools that are trying to do that sort of thing and go there and invest some time in there. I do classes every year at the Gerontology School beyond just sort of speaking stuff and all that and some mentoring. Students need to see that they can have viable careers. And not just viable careers, but be in a job where you really make a difference in people's lives. And one of the things that I always loved about being a nursing home administrator is, you know, you get out of school, you're 23 or 24 years old, and you're running your own business. That's got, and you have to learn everything. You have to learn clinical stuff and business stuff and marketing stuff, right? And you've got all different kinds of employees with different skill sets and it doesn't matter who you work for, you are the leader in that organization and you're imprinting it. How many other jobs?
None.
Right?
Right? Yeah. Nowhere.
And right. That's, you know, and if you're someone who's got sort of that independent streak or, you know, you want to be a little more entrepreneurial or whatever, what a great environment to do that in. So to me, there are so many levels on which it should be really attractive to people. And I think for the new generation that really likes to have that sort of independence and they kind of want to do it the way they want to do it. I mean, you still have parameters you need to work with, obviously, but, you know, I think there's some really good opportunities there. So I think we all need to spend time doing that kind of outreach and showing people that, you know, they can have a really fulfilling professional career life.
Totally agree. And the statement that you made, we need to go there. You know, that's, it's really easy for us to throw a stone at the educational system and say, hey, they're not creating programs to, but I think we kind of do a sucky job, at getting out and telling our story. So we got to do more of that. So, that's really encouraging that you have those efforts. We've heard that more lately, that more people are following that lead and getting out and doing that. We've had a little bit of an opportunity to do that ourselves. And the students just are, their eyes light up when they start hearing about it. And right. They've never heard about it before. And they're like, wow, almost anything that I've been studying in school, business or not business, I can apply that in senior living at some point. So.
Yeah, and plus other countries are so far behind, and you've got huge demographic issues like in Asia. Like one of the things we see at the SC school is there's a ton of international students, and they really do want to learn, and we're not here just to serve the elderly in our country. You want to just serve the elderly, period.
Right.
And so to the extent you can do anything to impart something to students that are coming here from other countries, I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Important
absolutely.
As well.
Yeah. Fun conversation.
Absolutely. So let's round out the show with let's talk a little bit of business. Rick, so what's on tap for Sabra this year? What are we going to see?
So for us, it's all about focusing on growth. We did a merger a couple of years ago. There was a lot of noise associated with it. We knew there would be, but we were trying to reposition the company and get it to sort of be a little bigger and stronger. And so we finished the repositioning about the end of first quarter last year, and then the rest of last year was focused on the balance sheet. We delevered. We did our first two investment grade bond offerings, and that was part of the result of that merger getting to investment grade. We redid our credit facility. We have $1 billion free on the line, and so we finished basically all that repositioning. So now it's, you know, let's really focus on growth, and plus keeping it simple. The street, we're public. The street doesn't like noise. We had noise for about 18 months. They'd rather have bad news because they can model bad news. You can't model noise, you know. So we're trying to, even though I like doing value creation things, we're trying to stay away from all that. Just sort of, you know, more predictable, stable kinds of things. But it's all about growth for us.
Got it. Love it.
So good. Well, we're rooting for that, and I'm sure, without a doubt, the success will continue to follow you guys. Well, Rick, thank you so much for taking time at a busy schedule at NIC here in your home state. You don't live too far from here?
Newport Beach.
Nice, so, nice.
A couple hours up the road.
Get to enjoy this incredible weather here.
Yeah.
And so we'll definitely connect with you and your organization in our show notes. I'm sure that our listeners are going to love this and have some questions. And for our listeners, you can follow us at btgvoice.com and all of our social media sites. Shoot us a DM. We'd love to hear from you. And thank you for listening to another great episode of Bridge the Gap.
Join the BTG podcast team at Argentum May 18th through the 20th and use our promo code BTGSLEC for $100 off a full conference pass. See you in Tampa. Visit btgvoice.com for more details.